When the Pulitzer Prizes were announced this week, among the winners was Harvard literary critic and scholar Steven Greenblatt. He won for general nonfiction for his fascinating work, The Swerve: How the World Became Modern.
The book examines the discovery and significance of a once-lost epic poem written by the Roman philosopher Lucretius in 50 BC. It's called On the Nature of Things.
The poem contains some thrilling and explosively controversial ideas that were well ahead of their time in 50 BC. Greenblatt says the poem helped shape the course of human thought, influenced the world's greatest thinkers, from Galileo to Einstein, from Shakespeare to Thomas Jefferson.
Among the ideas in Lucretius's poem, there is no creator or grand plan. All organized religions are superstitious delusions. Lucretius also said this more than 2,000 years ago. We are all made of minute particles, the very same matter as the stars and oceans. There's no afterlife, and we should not live in fear of the gods or of death, but in pursuit of pleasure.
Last October, I talked to Steven Greenblatt about his book, The Swerve, and about the poem that inspired it. We're going to play a bit of that interview again today. When I spoke to him, Greenblatt explained why the poem On the Nature of Things resonated so strongly with him the first time he read it.
My mother had experienced what basically most people experienced before the 1930s, let's say, with the introduction of penicillin. Just the year before penicillin came in, my mother lost a younger sister to strep throat. This must have been part of the ordinary experience of most families, not just my family. And it left deep scars in my mother. It left deep scars in people for centuries. And my mother spent much of the rest of her life in the shadow of death and of fearing death. So when I read a work, and it hit me at just the right moment when things sometimes do, when I read a work that came from an unimaginably distant past that said the fear of death is absurd, you shouldn't focus on death or the anxieties of disappearance. You should focus on now, on the miracle of your existence now, and take pleasure in that existence. It spoke to me as if it were a voice that had come from me personally.
Mm. So, Steven Greenblatt, who was Lucretius? What do we know about him?
We don't know a lot about him, Anthony. We know that he was celebrated by at least some people in his time, by the poet Ovid and Virgil, as a great poet. We know that he was a contemporary of Cicero's, of Julius Caesar's. He lived in that period of the end of the Roman Republic. But we don't know much about him personally. The few things that we know come of a personal kind come from much, much later, from a Christian source, St. Jerome, who may or may not have been telling reliable stories. What we know from inside the work is that Lucretius was a passionate follower of an older Greek philosopher named Epicurus.
Mm. And he's the sort of famous, or he's well known as sort of the philosopher of pleasure, I guess. Is that a fair way
yes.
to describe him?
Epicurean
yeah.
still
yeah, sure, it
means
still has that.
That.
Meaning, yeah.
I consult a website called Epicurus that tells me how to cook very delicious food. But Epicurus himself actually was, for all we know, a rather modest living man who thought that pleasure, deep pleasure, the pleasure that mattered, was not about binge drinking or binge eating, but about finding a kind of inner calm, and who tried to think of how to find that calm in relation to a vision of the way things are in the universe, the fact that this is all we have, that there's not going to be another round after we die, that we have to sort of seize what we can in this life.
So in Swerve, in your book, you show how this poem becomes really the most radical and talked about essays of the Renaissance period and beyond. How was it received at first? I mean, I can imagine, and you write about this, that the church must not have loved it.
Yes, they regarded it as either insane or as wicked. That the things that you listed at the beginning and that we've talked about, the principles in that work, are like an inquisitor's manual of things to look out for, beliefs that you absolutely don't want to tolerate. On the other hand, the people who first found it saw immediately that it was extremely beautiful. They had very good Latin. They understood Latin poetry, and they saw that this was written in the manner of the great poets of Ovid and Virgil. They loved it. they actually wanted to use it as a school book, and they did use it as a school book because it's also a schoolmaster's dream because it's incredibly difficult. So you could force your students to try to grapple with something at once important and difficult. And it was only after a century that they said, what? We can't use this as a school book. And they banned it from the schools when they fully took in what it was saying. Mm. But the fact that it took them almost a century, Anthony, suggests that the message was so weird when it came back that it was difficult to get in focus as anything that a civilized Christian could believe in.
Mm. And you show the huge impact this poem ended up having on humanist thinkers, from the folks who were around the time when it was discovered to people like Machiavelli, Shakespeare, Montaigne, Thomas More, right up to Thomas Jefferson. How did it affect so many people?
Well, the impact at first is very much under the radar. That's the key thing to say. Mm. It's extremely dangerous, even if you could associate yourself with this work, even if you could see that it might make sense that the world is just made up out of atoms and void. You would get in horrible trouble if you identified publicly with this for centuries after the work came back. So the initial reception, with very few exceptions, is under the radar, but it's percolating. It's quietly making its way in the world. And it's really only after something like 200 years that it begins fully to surface. And when it does surface after almost 200 years, in 1600, let's say, when Giordano Bruno, the Italian philosopher, said, yes, this is the way the things are in the world, Bruno was dragged out and burned at the stake in Rome. So it was a very long process. And if it did influence things, as I think it did profoundly, it influenced things in subtle and indirect ways before it influenced them in the more direct and perceivable ways. Mm.
It shows up, you refer to how Shakespeare absorbed some of the principles of this poem. For example, in Romeo and Juliet, right? In the great scene before the lovers are going to kill themselves, they don't talk about some life ever after. They talk about it all just ending right there.
Yes. It's very strange because Shakespeare, we know Shakespeare's source for Romeo and Juliet. He took the story, tended in general to borrow things that were already in circulation. So he took the story from Italian sources that had Romeo and Juliet actually speak of their afterlife, of meeting in the afterlife, and of people after they're dead speaking of their being united in the afterlife. But Shakespeare dropped that. He dropped the idea that there was going to be an afterlife for Romeo and Juliet, and instead he had those remarkable lines of Juliet's about Romeo being cut up in little stars and making the world in love with night. And for that matter, he has a very strange thing, which is he makes a joke, he has Mercutio make a joke about the little atomies, he calls them, that are drawing the chariot on which Queen Mab, the is floating across the nose of the dreamer. Now, he's not a private writer, Shakespeare. He's a public writer. So he expected some significant portion of the 2,000 listeners that he had in the theater to get and laugh at a joke about atoms in the 1590s. That means that a lot more was circulating, as they say, under the radar than we've realized.
That's Harvard Humanities Professor Stephen Greenblatt from an interview last October about his book, The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. Greenblatt won the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction this week. You can hear our full interview with him, including the story of how a 15th century papal secretary discovered that long-lost poem by Lucretius. All of that is at radioboston.org.
Our show is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at boston.com.
Radio Boston is produced by Adam Ragusa, Jessica Alpert, Dan Mawsey, Amory Sievertson. Our interns are Annie Ropeek and Mira Sharma.
Tim Skog is our technical director. We've had help this week from Eddie Mazulis.
The executive producer of Radio Boston is Mark Naven.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.